Each year, Lee Raymond held a private retreat for ExxonMobil's most senior executives. At the first such conference after the merger, Raymond told the assembled, "ExxonMobil is different than either Exxon or Mobil. It will occupy a different position in the economy and the industry." Raymond was referring obliquely to his intention to leverage the merger to reinvent Exxon. It would have been easiest for Raymond to have managed the absorption of Mobil by just taking the acquired company apart and then bolt the pieces onto Exxon's existing divisions while seeking cost efficiencies. Raymond had rejected that approach. He intended to use the merger to restructure Exxon itself. "Everybody is going to have a new job," he announced. As the merger proceeded, more people from Exxon than from Mobil departed or were let go, accounting for their relative size before the deal. With his withering inquisitions and his relentless push for financial excellence, Raymond managed to some extent by using insecurity as a motivation tool. It was up to the senior department heads to interpret his dogma about ExxonMobil's being different from either of its predecessor companies. Raymond would judge the result. In public affairs, Cohen understood the chief executive's edict as an invitation to rethink the corporation's brand position. ExxonMobil spent very little money on advertising or image building for a company of its size. Typically, in previous decades, oil companies had mainly invested their advertising and marketing budgets in their highly competitive retail gasoline businesses. Exxon's version of this marketing campaign had centered on the well-known "Put a Tiger in Your Tank" slogan, until Kellogg's, the corporate home of Tony the Tiger, of Frosted Flakes renown, persuaded Exxon to drop the Tiger as part of a trademark infringement settlement. The Greenpeace protesters in Tiger suits were out of date. The truth about gasoline, however, was that it was basically all the same. Each of the major oil companies blended in a few unique chemical additives to improve the fuel's performance, and then spent large sums of money on ads promoting the supposed superiority of its magic formula. Convenience stores, credit cards, and membership point schemes later enhanced these campaigns for retail market share. "We're drivers, too," was the bland slogan that ExxonMobil adopted after it lost its Tiger. Given the corporation's business performance, it returned to the top of the Fortune 500 in April 2001 and earned $15 billion in profits that year, more than any corporation in America. It was not obvious what strategy of image building ExxonMobil required. After the merger with Mobil, Raymond cut about 20,000 jobs and reduced operating costs by a further $8 billion after initially promising investors that he would save only about $3 billion. The extra $5 billion in savings partly reflected what Raymond had believed all along, that it would be possible to achieve more cuts than he had advertised publicly when the merger was announced. After the deal closed, Raymond told his top two executives, Harry Longwell and René Dahan, that he wanted the combined company, within 3 or 4 years, to be no larger than Exxon had been before the merger, without counting the additional people who would be necessary to run new refineries or chemical plants. Raymond's ambitious goal reflected his long-standing conviction that Exxon's management was underutilized and had the capacity to take on harder problems. Raymond's financial strategy was clear, but it was less obvious how spending on public policy, image advertising, and lobbying could help. Raymond had made up his mind about global warming policy and environmental policy, and he was not about to revisit his thinking to appease activists or uncompromising Democrats. In any event, big, highly profitable oil companies were not likely ever to enjoy wide enthusiasm in the populist-influenced United States, or anywhere else for that matter. Worldwide, Cohen's private opinion surveys showed, ExxonMobil enjoyed a top reputation among oil companies in only one country, Singapore, a tiny, authoritarian free-trading state where the corporation was a big investor and whose top-down conformist culture strikingly resembled that found in the God Pod at Irving. Ken Cohen and his public affairs team researched the history of Standard Oil and successor companies' ad campaigns during the 20th century, and they reviewed the public opinion results those campaigns achieved. The numbers fluctuated between terrible and tolerable. But Cohen's group could find no evidence of a golden age of oil company popularity. Exxon could not afford to accept low public esteem as a given, however. Engineering and scientific talent in the United States was in high demand. The corporation competed with other supermajors to recruit the most talented geophysicists and geologists at the world's top schools. Scientists who agreed to join entered a 2-year training program, a kind of free graduate school in which ExxonMobil invested tens of thousands of dollars to advance their skills in applied settings. The children of the baby boomer generation had been reared during an age of environmentalism, and it would be difficult to recruit and retain the best and brightest of them if working at ExxonMobil seemed a morally compromised choice. "There's a big population of liberal young folks in the company," a former manager recalled. These left-leaning employees wrestled among themselves with how they could be liberals and still work at ExxonMobil. Some of them pushed for paternity benefits and nursing rooms at the office, and succeeded. But these were incremental achievements, and the ambivalence remained. The difference between excellent and mediocre geologists could be the difference between finding oil and failing to do so. Scientists could be an independent-minded lot. Young ExxonMobil geologists often received poaching recruitment offers after 4 or 5 years of employment. Salaries at ExxonMobil were modest by industry standards, except for the very best performers who were well rewarded. British Petroleum's pay scale, for example, meant that it could often offer significant raises to geological scientists, $20,000 or more. After the merger, ExxonMobil became concerned about unusually high attrition rates in these talent wars. The corporation seemed to have particular difficulty holding on to women. Senior management organized listening post meetings with invited groups of senior department leaders and asked them, "Are you proud of your experience at the corporation? What do we need to do to keep you here?" Some of the rising managers were frank. "Look, we have a really bad reputation as a company." Informally, the employees talked about it all the time, a manager who participated recalled.